All right, Ray and Teresa actually led one of our church plants for many years. And Omero, his church is one of our grandchildren church plants. So we've known each other for a long time. And I was going to say that until I met my Latino brothers, I didn't realize how time and task-oriented I was. And that I would probably live 5 years longer by knowing them. But after their performance tonight, I don't know. Because they were very on time. I love this meeting. It's great to be with people who love to talk about all my favorite subjects. And I hope you guys are like really paying attention, because the talks that we've had, starting with Michael and Michael yesterday and Jay Pavlik this morning, I've just been incredible. I was listening to Jay this morning and just thinking, like, oh man, I would have given anything to have heard this 38 years ago. He said some really amazing things, actually. I don't know if you caught this. It was like he treated it like a throwaway, like just about, blew me out of my seat when he said, the kingdom of God theology is perfectly suited for the model of faith in exile. And there are a bunch of other things. Jay, if you can like get it in print so like we can actually study what you said, that would be really nice. But what I wanted to say was, like, if you put the three talks together, it's really revolutionary for like how we do mission in a secular environment. It's like a blueprint. Like, how can we be thoroughly biblical without any compromise and yet be fully incarnational in a postmodern world? That's the blueprint they've given to us. I think, what we've gotten here is like really top quality and really important. And so tonight I'm going to do something completely different. Which is to say, what they're talking about, it can be done. And in fact, it has been done. We're really part of a longer story as well as a bigger story. And what I've been asked to do tonight is talk to you about some incarnational leaders who are models of what we're talking about. And so I was looking for people who, took that love of Jesus and put that into the world in very concrete ways, and leaving their own comfort to like take that into the world. That's how I understand being incarnational. And of course, there are thousands of possibilities. If you know me well, you know that for fun, I read history. And I know that's weird, but that's me. I can never get enough of it. So I had lots of possibilities, but I picked three. And the three I picked because not only are they important models, because I believe that what they did was such that it made a pathway that many have followed since. They did something that opened up new ways of thinking, new ways of doing ministry that literally led to centuries of a different way of doing mission. All three of them. And, I believe that one individual called by God really can make a difference, which is why every single person matters. And I believe that all the believers are called to make a difference. I love sort of that Quaker thing that we have in the vineyard. Everybody gets to play. In case you didn't know, that's where it comes from. So, anyway, these people, I think, are really special. On August 27th, 1727, a small group of people gathered for what you might call a chain-style prayer meeting. Different groups had signed up for 1 hour of a 24-hour prayer meeting so that the prayer wouldn't cease, so that they could pray around the clock. I don't think they necessarily thought it at the time or expected it, but that prayer meeting lasted 24 hours a day, day and night, nonstop, for over 100 years. And I would argue that this one prayer meeting was used by God to change the church and change the world. A little more than 27 years earlier from that prayer meeting, our first model was born. On May 26, 1700 in Austria, what's now Austria, it was a time when most of the church was very lukewarm. The Protestant Reformation had kind of grown cold. The society was in reaction because they'd just gone through a whole century of religious warfare, so nobody wanted to be extreme. And up to that point in time, no Protestants had been engaged in any kind of mission activity. It was all about just fighting the Catholic Church, but there was no real missionary impulse. Now, I know that there's another story from the Catholic side, particularly with the Jesuits, but in the Protestant side, nothing had happened. So anyway, May 26, 1700, a man named Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf und Pottendorf, Imperial Count of Zinzendorf and Pottendorf, was born. And you can tell by the multiplicities of his name, he must have been somebody important. We know him primarily today as Count Zinzendorf, much easier. His family was old aristocracy. But as it happened, his parents were among those people who first really began to embrace the idea of born again, of being born again. That's like old to us, but there was a time when like that was really revolutionary. They were really sympathetic to the new movement of what was called Pietism, which is kind of really, you know, that it emphasized the fact that our faith is meant to be experienced, not just believed, but meant to be experienced. And that was all part of that thing. So his parents, even though they were German aristocracy, were sympathetic to that movement. However, his father died when he was only 6 weeks old. His mother later remarried, moved back to Berlin, leaving him in the care of his godly grandmother, who would read to him from the Bible every day and take him to church every Sunday. And as a young boy, he gave his life to Christ because the Pietists emphasized that that's what you need to do. You need to give your life to Jesus and begin an experiential relationship with him, which at the time was like absolutely revolutionary. So he gave his life to Christ, and he learned there to talk to Jesus out loud as a friend continually. He was very intelligent, and when it was time for school, he was sent to a boarding school, as was the norm. And once there, he was mercilessly picked on by other students. And also, in what would be a huge scandal today, controlled by one of his teachers to extort money from home, the teacher sort of destroying his letters home so his parents wouldn't really know what was happening to him. In spite of all that, he excelled academically, and during his last years at boarding school, in spite of all of that difficulty, he established 7 prayer groups for fellow students, and he formed his own fraternity called the Laudable Order of the Mustard Seed, which grew and eventually included a number of people who went on to places of great influence in both church and government. From there, he went on to university after graduation, which, as was the norm for aristocrats, he was sent on a tour of Europe sort of to kind of round out your education and sort of decompress you from university life before you came back home. And so he did that, and while he was on this tour, he saw in one of the places a painting of the suffering Savior with a crown of thorns on his head with the title of the painting was Behold the Man. But under the painting, there was another inscription written in small letters underneath it, which read, "This I suffered for you, what are you doing for me? And at that moment, it just came alive in his heart. And it was like on fire. It just burned into him far beyond anything that he had previously experienced. And for the whole rest of his life, the main theme of his preaching and all the other things that he did was actually the suffering Christ and what are we doing for him. And he determined right then and there that he would spend his life in service of Christ, which was just not done by aristocratic boys. Shortly before his marriage, at the age of 22, he bought an estate with a mansion and a large piece of land, and his whole intention was that he would establish there a Christian community. The pastor of the church there was also a pietist, and when they broke the ground on the first day or had their first service on the grounds, this pietist pastor gave a prophetic word, and he said, God will light a candle on this place which will illuminate the whole land. Meanwhile, Zinzendorf joined a small cell group meeting, and at this meeting he met a carpenter from a region known as Moravia. The ruler of Moravia was a Roman Catholic, and all the Lutherans and Pietists were continually persecuted by this ruler, and so a lot of them were leaving their homes and moving into the area where Count Zinzendorf was living. And so he placed this carpenter under his sort of governmental protection and invited him to bring his family and other persecuted friends and family from Moravia to a nearby property, to his mansion, to establish this new community. And so the Moravians began to come. And they called their community Herrnhut, which means under the Lord's watch. More and more refugees continued to arrive, and by 1724, they had numerous people. They'd built a community center with a large room for meetings, classrooms, library, pharmacy, and more people continued to come, and he welcomed them all. But all these new arrivals actually weren't all from the same place, and they had lots of different ideas about things like communion and ceremonies and customs. And it wasn't long before they were all fighting with each other. And it was pretty brutal. I mean, you think, you know, sometimes we think, you know, it's the modern church that's nasty to each other. And all I can tell you is nastiness is not exclusive to modern people. There was one of the men turned up there who was saying terrible things about Zinzendorf, calling him a tool of the devil and the beast from the abyss and all kinds of stuff. I mean, they went wild. And if you want to see how it was, just read some of the writings of Martin Luther. I mean, like, he could let it loose like you wouldn't believe, you know. So it was kind of the way they were. So it was a pretty nasty fight. And at the time that this fight arose in the community, Zinzendorf is actually still kind of following his career. He's got a legal position in the capital city of his section of Germany in Dresden. You know, and he's like, he owns this property, he's let these people be there, but he's not there, he's not running it, he's somewhere else. But in the wake of this conflict, he resigned his position and began to devote his whole time to helping this community get back to health, like, because they were, like, messed up. And he went back and pleaded with people and prayed with people, and on Sunday, May 12th, 1727, he spoke to the 300 residents for about 3 hours, interestingly. Concerning unity and basic principles of love. He just wasn't going to let them leave the room until they, like, repented, I think. And so eventually, that resulted in a signed document of what they called the Brotherly Agreements, which restored peace to the community. By August, so that happened in May, in early August, Zinzendorf and 14 other leaders of that community spent the whole night in spiritual conversation and prayer. They were trying to press in to God. And the next Sunday, in the afternoon service, the local pastor was so overcome by the power of the Spirit that they say he sank down into the dust. In other words, I think What that means is out cold, undone. And people then began to weep over their sins and ask forgiveness there and then of God and of each other. And then following Sunday, August 13th, 1727, there was an outpouring of the Holy Spirit on the whole community. And as the group was singing a hymn, the presence of God became so thick that the people began weeping and crying all over the room so loudly that they were drowning out the singing. And they spent the whole day together because nobody wanted to leave and go home. And Zinzendorf considered that one day to be the fulfillment of the prophecy made back when he first purchased the property, that God would light a lamp there. And interestingly, there were two brothers who had gone on a trip. They'd been in Hungary, and they came back. And when they came back, they said, what happened at 10 o'clock in the morning on August 13th? Because even though they were in Hungary, at 10 o'clock in the morning on August 13th, the Holy Spirit fell on them as well at the same time. That group then became known as the Moravians, and they've come down through history known as the Moravians. But they were really one of the earliest of sort of modern-day Holy Spirit movements. 2 weeks later, after this outpouring of the Spirit, the 24 men and the 24 women made the commitment to pray around the clock, thus beginning the 100-year prayer meeting. In the prayer meeting, they would pray for those in prison, for those who were ill, and eventually the many needs of those who were on the mission fields. Zinzendorf began to publish what was called Watchword for the Day, which was some Bible verses and perhaps some verses from a hymn given out for each day for daily contemplation. It's now known as the Moravian Daily Texts. It's sort of their own version of, you know, like a prayer book or something like that. And so the Moravian Daily Texts have now been published continuously for over 280 years, with a publication right now in modern times over 1.5 million. At the same time, Zinzendorf also wrote hundreds of hymns for the group, most of them focusing on the cross of Christ, which they would sing with all they had. He encouraged the practice of forming cell groups in every place. So he's a real pioneer of the idea of, like, let's get together in these cell groups and, you know, build up our faith that way. And so cell groups began to spread all over Europe. There were hundreds of them all over Europe. And interestingly, way far ahead of his time, Zinzendorf openly, clearly allowed women to minister in important positions and taught that there were no biblical restrictions upon what women could do in ministry, encouraging them to preach and teach in his own congregation. Oh, so it's like 300 years before, like, everybody else caught on. He was a man of the Spirit. Interestingly, he wasn't a pastor and wasn't, under any of the normal rules, allowed to be a pastor. Aristocrats like him were really under obligation to their kings, and you were expected to serve in court and in the government, and you did not become a pastor. But he wanted nothing more than to be a preacher and a pastor. And after about 20 years, it finally did happen that he was ordained as a pastor and a bishop for the Church of the Brethren, but it was a long time in coming. 4 years after the outpouring in 1727, God began to speak to the congregation that he was preparing them to be the salt of the earth by going out as missionaries. And while Zinzendorf was on a business trip to Denmark, he met a former slave there from St. Thomas in the Caribbean. This man was a Christian and spoke Danish, and so they were able to converse, and he said to the count, if only a missionary would go to my island and tell my sister and my brother about Jesus, they would believe as I do. And Zinzendorf there and then decided to invite him back to Herrnhut, and he brought this former slave from St. Thomas back to Herrnhut, where he told the community about what was really going on in St. Thomas and the horrible conditions of the slaves in the Caribbean. At that time, two young men were so moved that they determined, we will go to the Caribbean and preach the gospel to the slaves. Their names were Leonard Dober, who was a potter, and David Nitschman, who was a carpenter. And they actually determined that if necessary, they would become slaves themselves in order to preach to the slaves, because everybody told them, you can't get there. The slave owners won't let you. They said, we'll sell ourselves into slavery, and then that way we can preach. In the end, they were able to go without becoming slaves. So a lot of times you hear the story, they stop at the early part. It's more dramatic. But actually, they didn't actually have to fall through. But before long, some 29 of the youngest and most promising young leaders of Heron Hoot followed them into the Caribbean to preach to the slaves, of whom, within a very short period of time, like less than a year, more than 20 died of yellow fever or malaria. But no amount of suffering would stop them. They continued to send more to the Caribbean. And by 1750, over 1,600 slaves had been converted. Eventually, over 6,000 would be baptized, and literally hundreds of Moravians would be sent from Heron Hoot to the Caribbean to take the gospel to the slaves. During all this time, Zinzendorf began to come under tremendous criticism, political intrigues at court, people who felt threatened by what he was doing, people who resented the fact that he was accepting all these refugees, that kind of thing. We wouldn't know anything about that. For 10 years, as a result of that, he was exiled from his home and his homeland. The ruler of his principality in Germany exiled him from home, banned him from being there. And so he began to use that to take many missionary journeys to other places. Okay, if I can't go home, then I'm going to go see the world. And he came even to America during that time period. And he persisted in the work in spite of all the criticism and the troubles along the way. And as they started different communities and different places, some of them had difficulties, and he was always trying to sort them out. The Moravians began to send out others to places where there were forgotten and oppressed people. They especially took on, under the direction of the Spirit, all the places where there were people who had been forgotten, people who were overlooked, people who were oppressed. By 1757, over 200 had gone out. By 1800, 70 years after the first great outpouring, over 1,000 had gone out from Heron Hoot all over the world. They went to places like Greenland, Newfoundland, South Africa, Russia, the Far East, the Arab world, and even Ohio. The Moravians were among the first to share the gospel with the native peoples of North America. So a lot of people don't realize is that when the English white settlers came into these places and began to exterminate these Indian tribes, many of them were already Christians. The Moravians were known for their faith in God and fearlessness in crisis. And it was one of their meetings that John Wesley was converted. What Count Zinzendorf did was to revitalize the church and begin a great movement of Protestant missions that continues to this day. And he established the idea that one could have a vital, intimate relationship with God that was more than just theology. And through it all, he remained continually focused on the glory of Christ. And just to kind of give you just a little taste, here's a quote from Count Zinzendorf himself, what he might have said to his people. In fact, what he did say to them. Do not digress even for a quarter of an hour from the loving Lamb of God. Name no virtue except in him. Preach no commandment except faith in him. No other justification but what he atoned for. No other sanctification but the privilege to sin no more in him. No other happiness but to be near him, think of him, and do his pleasure. No greater loss than to be deprived of him. No greater calamity but to displease him. No other life but in him. Second man There's a man whose name will be familiar to, I think, nearly all of you, a man named William Wilberforce. Born 255 years ago, in another time period when serious biblical faith was considered primitive and even dangerous. In his time, to be labeled a Methodist was sort of like being called a fundamentalist today. It was, if you wanted to be like really out of fashion and really sort of, you know, barbarian, you would be a Methodist in the view of most people of his time. Most of the established clergymen of his time, in fact, had no faith at all. They were completely atheistic or agnostic, almost all of them. William Wilberforce's father died when he was 10 years old, and he was sent to live with his uncle and his aunt, who were very unusual because they were extremely wealthy people in England, but also essentially Methodists. And they were friends with two very important men, one named George Whitefield and the other one, John Newton, the former slave trader, converted to Jesus, agitator for the abolition of slavery, writer of Amazing Grace, and so forth. After 2 years, his mother figured out, like, this was a bad idea. He's turning into a Methodist. She brought him back and did everything she could think of to stamp out any Methodist tendencies he might have. At university, he fell in with a group of rich but frivolous friends who spent most of their time in witty exchanges and pursuits of pleasure. Wilberforce, though he was extremely short, he was probably only about this tall, shorter than my wife is. So he was a short man, a small man. He had an outsized personality and was considered the most charming of the bunch, of all of his friends. And they were the kind of people, aristocratic, rich people, didn't really take university seriously. They kind of partied their way through and bought their way out of their troubles and, you know, went like that. At the age of 24, he was elected to Parliament, representing one of the most influential counties in the country, because money can buy you anything. Later that year, he went on a holiday with a man who was both incredibly intelligent but also a committed Methodist. And on this trip, and you have to imagine a holiday to the south of France by coach. So you have a lot of time cooped up together on your way there. So on the trip, they read a Methodist-oriented book, discussed matters of faith constantly. And before the trip was over, Wilberforce was now irrevocably, fully, truly converted to the cause of Christ. He called it the Great Change. And his first impulse at that point was, I should leave politics and pursue ministry, because that's what everybody expected, that if you were serious about your faith, you weren't in politics. And so that's what he was going to do. He was going to leave politics, pursue ministry, do that whole thing. If you were, you know, nobody else had done it that any other way. But he had a long conversation with John Newton and was finally convinced that God wanted him to live out his faith by trying to do good through politics. And in so doing, he was among the very first in modern times to open a path and a model for serious Christians in politics, and it would have an impact for generations all around the world. You see, everywhere on the globe, for over 5,000 years or more, the idea of human civilization without slavery was unimaginable. But it wasn't long after Wilberforce's great change that he chose the abolition of slavery, beginning with the abolition of the slave trade, as his first great purpose in life. Wrote it down, my purpose in life, I'm going to bring this to an end. Now, at first he thought, if I just educate people about the evils of the slave trade, that will bring about a great change. And he did a lot of stuff to educate people. There was a lot of misinformation, a lot of no information. He dug it out. He got the stories from the people who were there and saw what it was really like. And all that did was make his opposition more hostile and more vehement. And he quickly found out that actually a lot of people had deep vested interest in the slave trade, and they fought back with all the guile and force possible. And They pulled all kinds of parliamentary tricks, you know, maneuvers of timing and bills and, you know, everything you could think of. Year after year after year, his bill to abolish the slave trade went down in defeat. He proposed it every year. Every year, it failed. Sometimes by very narrow margins. One time by one vote. And the guy that caused them to lose the vote had been induced by free opera tickets to go to the opera instead of doing his job. Then the French Revolution came about, and the horrors of the guillotine and the terror in the French Revolution, and English society associated anything progressive with that, with the French Revolution and sort of the excesses of that. So the idea of abolition of slavery just went, like, that's too much like what the French are saying, so we don't want anything to do with it. And besides which, the country was primarily focused on what became a desperate war that would last for over 20 years. During those 20 years, Wilberforce continued to persist year after year with his bill. He was lied about in the press, mocked, threatened, attacked verbally and physically. Over the years, he began to use petitions from the citizens of Great Britain to try to bolster his cause, at one point presenting a petition with nearly 1 million signatures, which represented nearly 10% of the whole population. Still, it didn't pass. And nobody had ever used petitioning in that way. It had never. It was like absolutely unprecedented, yet he persisted. Finally, February 23rd, 1807, the bill abolishing the slave trade was passed. Then he had to pass additional measures to actually enforce the law because the slave traders continued to smuggle slaves against the law. And then there was the issue of abolishing slavery in all of the British possessions because while this trade was abolished, the ownership of slaves was not. Finally, on July 26, 1833, he was told that the final pieces would be in place to guarantee passage of the bill abolishing slavery itself, and 3 days later he died. But his great goal was accomplished because on July 31, 1834, 800,000 slaves in the British Empire became free. Now, there's a biographer named Eric Metaxas, wrote a great book on this, who said, Wilberforce did more than just take the lead in abolishing slavery. And this is what I want you to understand, because you all knew that he'd done that part. What Wilberforce vanquished, he says, was something even worse than slavery. Something that was much more fundamental and can hardly be seen from where we stand today. He vanquished the very mindset that made slavery acceptable and allowed it to survive and thrive for millennia. He destroyed an entire way of seeing the world, one that had held sway from the beginning of history, and he replaced it with another way of seeing the world. Now, interestingly, he had a second great purpose in life. That was only purpose one, which took his entire life, almost his entire adult life. But he had another one called the Reformation of Manners. Now, you're going to misunderstand that if you understand it as about manners, like, you know, whether you put your elbows on the table. That's not what he's talking about. Okay? In his time, there were two normal responses to the poor. Either to look down on them as inferior and unworthy of help, or to ignore them entirely, considering their plight inevitable. Wilberforce wanted to change that attitude, and that's what he meant by reformation of manners. And throughout his life, he started or supported dozens of homes, asylums, orphanages, other groups to support, protect, and help the poor. I mean, like, the list is long. You're talking, like, 60, 70, 80 organizations that were designed to take a different approach to the poor, that they're not, this is not their fault, they're deserving of help, it's not hopeless. He worked also to abolish the practice of burning a widow with her husband's body in India. Wow. And he worked hard as well to share his faith with fellow members of parliament, using all of his charm, wit, and intelligence to show them that one could have faith and still be educated and enjoyable to be with. You didn't have to be dull or drab in order to be spiritual, and he literally evangelized half of parliament. When he died, by special request of parliament, he was buried in Westminster Abbey, and I found the wording of the plaque on his grave very moving. So I'd like to finish by reading it, what they said about his life. William Wilberforce, for nearly half a century a member of the House of Commons, in an age and country fertile in great and good men, he was among the foremost of those who fixed the character of their times, because to high and various talents, to warm benevolence, and to universal candor, he added the abiding eloquence of a Christian life. Eminent as he was in every department of public labor and a leader in every work of charity, whether to relieve the temporal or the spiritual wants of his fellow man, his name will ever be specially identified with those exertions which, by the blessing of God, removed from England the guilt of the African slave trade and prepared the way for the abolition of slavery in every colony of the empire. In the prosecution of these objects, he relied not in vain on God, but in every progress he was called to endure great obloquy and great opposition. He outlived, however, all enmity. He died not unnoticed or forgotten by his country. The peers and commons of England, with the Lord Chancellor and the Speaker at their head, carried him to his fitting place among the mighty dead around here to repose, tell through the merits of Jesus Christ, his only Redeemer and Savior, whom in his life and his writings he had desired to glorify. He shall rise in the resurrection of the just. Now, I'm willing to bet that most of you have not ever heard of my third person, but I felt that it was really important to talk about her as our third model. Her name is Lillian Trasher. She was born on September 27th, 1887, grew up in Brunswick, Georgia. As a girl, she knelt by a log in the woods one day, and she prayed a very faithful prayer. She said, "Lord, if ever I can do anything for you, just let me know and I'll do it." Sort of, I love that prayer, but I have to shake my head about it too. Years later, she met Miss Perry, a woman who ran an orphanage nearby, who invited her to come and work at the orphanage. Little did Lillian know that this was where she would get her training for her entire life's work. Later, she arrived at what was called the Elhana Training Institute, where she was involved in sewing, cooking, taking care of newborn babies, and taking care of large numbers of orphan children. It was there that she learned to trust God for the needs of everyday life. She had no money at all, and no one sent her any. She never wrote to others about her needs. Her shoes wore out, and there was no money to buy a new pair, but somebody had sent in a box of aid clothes, and there was a pair of men's shoes in the box, and so she wore those. From there, she went to a Bible school in Cincinnati, Ohio. Then she pastored a church in Dahlonega, Georgia. I don't know if any of Georgians know where that is. Is that how you say it? Dahlonega, Georgia. There we go. Also did evangelistic work in Kentucky, and in 1909 returned to the orphanage in Marion, North Carolina. She had been praying about a call to the mission field, but in the meantime had become engaged to be married. 10 days before her wedding day, she accompanied Miss Perry to hear a missionary from India, and she was so deeply touched by the message that she cried through the service all the way back to the orphanage and on into the night, like sobbing, racking sobs. So Miss Perry wanted to know what was wrong, and Lillian explained to her that nothing was wrong except that she was engaged to marry the most wonderful young man in the world, and she could not marry him because God had called her to Africa and she must obey. She had to put God first. Knowing little about where she was to go, she gathered her few possessions and a few dollars and went to a missionary convention in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, believing that God would speak to her there, that he would also provide, as he always did, and he did. In the short time, she got the provision to go to Brooklyn, New York, and some sort of direction to go to Egypt. So her sister joined her. Someone had urged her, well, ask God for a promise to kind of, you know, confirm your sense that you're supposed to go to Egypt. So she says, okay. So she flips open her Bible, and it lands at Acts 7:34, which says, I have seen the affliction of my people, which is in Egypt, and I have heard their groaning, and am come down to deliver them, and now come, I will send thee into Egypt. So the two sisters climbed on the freighter alone and went to Egypt. They docked in Alexandria and then traveled by train south to Cairo and then further south down the Nile River to a town called Aswit. And she thought it was the most beautiful place in the world. It wasn't long before she was confronted by Egypt's needs, those of poor, homeless, ragged, rejected children. And one night at midnight, a man knocked on her door. And he was looking for someone to come pray with a woman who was dying. So Lillian, accompanied by an interpreter, went, having no idea what she would find. When she got there, she was horrified to discover a three-month-old baby girl trying to suck green, stringy milk out of a tin can. Her clothes had been sewn tightly on her, and it seemed as though she hadn't been changed maybe since she'd been born. The stench, she said, was beyond belief. Lillian prayed, and the mother was dying right there and then. And as the mother died, she gave the baby to Lillian, who took the child back with her to the compound because there was no one else there. The two sisters took turns rocking the child and trying to get her to take some milk, and for 12 days and nights, they tried, and the baby howled. And it was nearly unbelievable that a malnourished child could actually cry so loudly and persistently, and pretty soon the other missionaries in the compound had had enough of this, and the senior missionary ordered her to take the baby back. But where was Lillian going to take the baby back to? She had come there to work within sort of the traditional mission structure, which insisted that single women must be submissive to the male leaders, and they had to live on the mission compound, separated from the rest of the people. And the veteran missionary, of course, knew best, so she decided to take the baby back, but she was going to go back with the baby herself to stay. So she took the baby, and then when the superior found out she was planning to go with the baby, said, you can't do that, you can't go there alone. It's not, you know, you can't do that in Egypt. It's not done. A woman can't be alone in a place like this. It's too dangerous. The local people will never accept it. You can imagine. You don't know what you're doing. You don't speak the language well enough, etc. An American woman, unmarried, in the Arab world with a baby. But Lillian felt like, I will not be alone if God is with me. So with the $60 she had left from her traveling, she rented a small house, bought a little stove and some furniture, and that was it, because her mission board terminated all her support because she wasn't doing it their way. So she's now alone. Her sister went back to Long Beach, California, and didn't return until many years later. She had no means of support, so she went out begging. Her first donation was 35 cents, which was enough for that day's food. Somehow she got given a donkey, so she went around on the donkey pleading for money, and many times as she went around the town asking for money to help support the child, there was one and then another and then another. Instead of giving them more support, they gave her more children. Instead, the government officials were amazed that no one did anything to alarm or hurt her. The governor taunted her because she was riding a donkey, which was considered very degrading for an attractive young lady. And Lillian said, well, a donkey was good enough for the mother of my lord, and so it's certainly good enough for me. And so she became known in town as the lady on the donkey. And the orphanage began to grow. And so she began to spend more and more time wondering about where's the next meal going to come from. But always the food or money always arrived just in time. Sometimes she traveled so far that she couldn't get back to the orphanage at night, so if nobody offered her a safe place to sleep, she'd go to the nearest police station and spend the night with her donkey in a jail cell. And the Egyptians just couldn't believe that an American would do this. By 1914, she became affiliated with a new denomination, the Assemblies of God, a Pentecostal group. And they began to send barrels of clothing and an occasional check, but she still mostly relied on the generosity of her Egyptian neighbors. She answered every letter she received on the same day. By 1915, she had 50 children in the orphanage. So she had to build additional buildings. And then somebody gave her some land. She put buildings on there. And the children helped with the construction, even down to making the bricks. She began teaching the children trades because they had to be prepared for life. And how else are they going to grow up and have a living? So by 1923, she had 300 orphans and now widows as well, who had no other place to go. So she found herself taking in widows as well as orphans and children. There had been no spiritual response over all those years, but in 1927, there was sort of the outpouring of the Spirit she had long waited for, and many of the people in her orphanage and the widows and the children experienced the power of the Spirit and, you know, conversion to Jesus and so forth. In the meantime, continual sewing, washing, feeding, building, raising funds, and praying. One night, when the Egyptians rose up against the British rulers, she had to move her children from the orphanage to a brick kiln because they got like roving bands of bandits. It's sort of like what you see, just take like what you see now in the Middle East in a lot of places. Well, this is not the first time that's happened. Let's just put it that way. This is not the first time that's happened, so there's all these roving people running around Egypt now, and so they leave the orphanage and run and hide in a kiln. They get all the kids in there. She counts head and realizes two kids are missing. So she crawls back to the orphanage, finds two toddlers, tucks one under each arm, and starts making her way back. But then the rebels are blocking her path, so she falls into a ditch where she finds herself lying on top of a dead body in the ditch and trying not to scream or make any noise and trying to help these toddlers not to make any noise. Have you ever tried to help a toddler not make noise? And so she started singing Jesus Loves Me in the ears of the babies, and the rebels moved a different direction and they escaped and got back to safety. Even though the nearby houses were looted and burned, the orphanage was untouched. And she told all her Egyptian neighbors of God's power. Over the years, she slowly gained the confidence of the Egyptians and the American churches. Then came the Great Depression. The American support money pretty much dropped to nothing. And she had so many children by now that she couldn't leave them and even go look for supplies or money. And so she just had to pray even more. And at numerous points would fall on the ground and just pray and sob and say, I just can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. It's too much. I can't do it. But God would always come through one thing after another. And then came World War II. And again, at one point in World War II, there's this amazing story. They're starving and she's praying and she literally gets given an entire ship full of supplies. Because somehow a ship got there and they didn't know what to do with all the stuff, and so somebody said, well, let's give to her. She eventually had the responsibility of seeing that 2,000 meals were provided daily, as well as books, clothing, needs of hundreds of children. They survived wars, revolution, the plague, fires, government suspicion and inspections, you name it, it happened to her. For 50 years, she stayed there working and only had one break to come back to America during that time period, which was actually forced on her by the British governor, who told her, I'm not going to let you stay. But again and again, she saw God's miraculous provision. And by the time she died, her orphanage had grown to over 1,200 children. And she had processed, taken care of and raised thousands. And everybody in all of Egypt called her the mother of the Nile. And it all meant that their lives were changed forever, and it all began with a simple prayer: if I can do anything for you, I'll do it. And I chose her because I think she opened the way for thousands of single women to follow her into the mission field. And she showed that the Muslim world was not unreachable. And she showed that there is a power in living with the people, even among Muslims, which just wasn't the way it was done. And she showed that God could provide, through any situation, those who would care for the helpless. So what do these three incarnational models have in common? I would just like to point out six characteristics. Number one, they all had incredible courage. They had, every single one of them, the courage to do what everybody else said could not be done. They heard the Spirit of the Lord call, and they refused to listen to the words that say it can't be done, whatever the cost. They obeyed. Anyone who's ever going to do anything great in incarnational ministry is going to run into it can't be done. Number two, compassion. All of them, they were moved by the suffering of those who were forgotten and ignored. For each one of them, that was really the first stop in the life of the Spirit. To listen to the Spirit is to care about those that nobody cares about, wherever they are. I believe the Spirit of God is still the same, and that there are still forgotten people in the world. Three, persistence. They persisted through all kinds of difficulties, reverses, criticisms, tensions. They persisted in the face of constant tension with the expectations of their time, with the norms of their culture at their time and place, the expectations of what they could and could not do. They persisted through it all. They didn't give up. They didn't turn back through whatever got dished out to them. They just kept going. Four, faith. They all exercised this unbelievable faith that God had called them, and so he would provide. They prayed a lot, every one of them. If you actually read their stories in detail, they prayed a lot, and they expected miracles, and they saw them. Again and again and again, they lived in the exercise of faith. Number five, wisdom. They weren't, any of them, afraid to use both natural and supernatural resources in the pursuit of their mission. They used everything they had at their disposal. Their money, their status, their connections, whatever they used. And finally, number six, their commitment. They sacrificed their personal comfort, their resources, their reputations for the work of God. For none of them was there anything like an easy retirement. There was in their life no real provision for future comfort. It was total commitment. And I find that tremendously convicting because I like my comfort. And all I will say is that we need those kind of people now. They all lived in times of tremendous turmoil. We live in a time of tremendous turmoil. They lived in times of tremendous injustice. We live in a time of tremendous injustice. They lived in a time when it seemed that the church had lost its fire. Sometimes it seems like we live in that time too. And it didn't make any difference. And we need people like you.